I'm an alcoholic. This is an open meeting of the Atlanta Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA. And since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons, Phil and Dino, have the lists of such groups and their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Rocco will read the preamble.
I'm Rocco, alcoholic. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contribution. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Please join me in the serenity prayer. God. Carl will read the steps.
That's perfect. Hello, everyone. My name is Carl, and I'm an alcoholic. Step one, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Step two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn the will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact natures of our wrong. Six, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked Him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Excuse me. 10. Continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for the knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we try to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Thank you.
Randy will read the traditions.
Hi, I'm Randy. I'm an alcoholic. Okay. 12 traditions. 1. Our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. 2. For our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as He may express Himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. 3. The only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. 4. Each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. 5. Each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6. An AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7. Every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8. Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. And 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers followed by our information break, and then our main speaker, who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Lauren.
Hi, I'm Lauren, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm very scared. I'm a member of the Atlantic Group. My sobriety date is January 11th, 2008. My sponsor is Christine L., and I'm currently working Step 9. I want to thank Debbie for asking me to speak. It's really crazy because a year ago when I was sitting out there, I would have never, ever thought I'd be standing here, and I probably would have canceled if somebody asked me to speak. So I've changed a lot. I grew up in Western Pennsylvania near Pittsburgh, and I started drinking pretty young, probably when I was in fifth grade. And drinking worked for a really long time. It worked in high school. I never really had any consequences. When I got to college, I had my first blackout, and I was really, really terrified because I didn't know anybody that ever had a blackout before. I had a boyfriend, and if you would have asked me if I would ever cheat on him, I would have said no. I mean, there was no way that I would ever do that. But I blacked out, and I did. And when I came to, I was completely, completely amazed at what I did. I mean, I could not believe that I would ever do that. And I stopped drinking at that point and did other substances for a while, because I could remember what I was doing. So I started drinking again my senior year of college, and this is when it started to pick up a lot. I started having blackouts pretty often. I started doing a lot of crazy things, and it started to be kind of like my, what I was. You know, everybody would tell the funny stories about what I was doing, and I kind of liked that. So I didn't mind getting drunk and doing, you know, going to get tattoos or piercings or doing really, you know, absurd things where I'm not going to even talk about that here. But, I mean, really, really things that were not something that I should be doing. And towards probably around the age of 23, things started to get worse. I started doing things that were really, I started feeling really, really bad. It wasn't funny anymore. People weren't laughing. They were taking care of me when I was drinking rather than, I was more of a nuisance. I had to be babysat. So I did a lot of geographics in 1 year. I moved from Pittsburgh to Johnstown, Pennsylvania, to DC, to Charlottesville, to New York, and that's all in 6 months. I came to New York and I could finally drink the way I wanted to drink. I didn't have to worry about driving. Everything was open late. And I thought, you know, this is perfect. I don't know anybody, so I can completely reinvent myself. I mean, pretty much within 2 weeks, I was doing the same stuff. I was blacking out with coworkers, and, you know, just throwing up at the bar, just doing really, really stupid things. I think my bottom lasted about 4 years. It was basically me living the same day over and over again. I met my current boyfriend during a blackout, and it was fun at first. You know, we would drink and, you know, have a good time, and I would wake up the next day and be a little hungover and go to work, and, you know, it was fine. But as my feelings started to grow for him, I started to drink over those feelings. If I was jealous, I would drink so that I could pass out and not feel those feelings. Or if he was going out with his friends, I didn't want to deal because I thought he was going to cheat on me. So I would drink to pass out. But the problem was I drank, blacked out, then pass out. So when I was in the blackout, I would call him, 50 times, call his parents, text his friends, punch him in the face. I mean, whatever it was, I made up stories. I basically made up stories in my head. And so if I was at a bar and he was sitting next to me the whole time and there was one other girl in the room across the room, I would think about cheating, and all of a sudden I was sure he just cheated on me. I was completely insane. And I really, really started to hate my life. And it was the same. I was living the same day over and over again. So, things just kept getting worse and worse, and it wasn't fun for him anymore. I would wake up every morning and I would ask, I don't know when it was ever fun, but I would ask him, are we okay? Some days we were, most days we weren't. And a few months before I quit my drinking, it was Halloween and I was at my worst. And I woke up and he was gone the next morning. I manipulated it or whatever. He came back, and soon after I ended up coming in. I had no experience with AA, so I don't even know how I got here, but one morning I woke up and I went to work and I Googled AA. And that morning was the day he was gonna leave me and I didn't know. So I guess that's a higher power moment. It's really odd because I never thought I had a drinking problem. I thought I was nuts and, couldn't control myself or had to be in a hospital or something, but I never thought it was drinking. So I came. My first meeting was the 79th Street workshop. Christine, who's my sponsor, was the speaker that night, and I completely related. And, I thought I was coming in to drink or be able to drink easier or get my drinking under control or something. I didn't know I was quitting. And the fact that she had me call her the next day helped me not drink that night. So, it's amazing that I'm even here. And I never thought I could ever go a week, let alone a year. I think listening to the suggestions of people is very important. A lot of times I didn't like what they were suggesting, and I didn't want to do it, but I believed that everybody was happy, and I did it anyways. And my life is 100% different. My relationship is actually good. I haven't woke up once this year and asked if we were okay. My job, I couldn't even work a year ago. I had a job, but I never did my work. And I actually can do my work today, which is absolutely crazy. And I'm actually getting complimented on it, which I've never done. It's never happened. Before they were trying to get rid of me. It's amazing. This is so weird. I was just talking about this before the meeting. Even my cat has changed. My cat, she's so much nicer to me when before, I don't know. It's odd. I guess for the newcomer, I believed it worked because I saw people that were happy, but I wasn't, so sure. But I'm here to tell you that it completely does work. You just have to listen to everybody's suggestions and get a sponsor and listen to the sponsor and do the stuff even if you don't want to and start reading the book and work the steps. I sat on my 4-step for a very long time. And it was very painful, but I did it. I think I needed the pain to do it. And it was hard, but when I was done, I felt awesome. So what else? I have a commitment. That's also very important. It helps you meet people in the program because this can be a little bit intimidating walking into a room full of people that all know each other. And what else? I guess I can talk about more things, how my life has changed. Cool, 1 minute. So that totally works. I guess all I have to say is that if you're new, give it time. Give it at least 90 days. Give it 6 months. Because, I mean, I wasn't going to even give it a month, and I just kept coming back. And eventually you get it, and you'll hold on to it and pass it on to somebody else. Thank you.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Mike.
Thanks, Marty. Hi, I'm Mike. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is August 25th, 2006. My sponsor is John. I'm working on steps 9, 10, 11, and 12. And Atlantic Group is my home group. Okay, moving right along. I'm really glad to be here and see a lot of people in their usual seats. You know, that makes me feel comfortable. And when I'm really glad to be here, I mean it. Because I should be dead. And I don't just say that because the things that I've done, like I've been in 7 alcohol-related car accidents, 4 of which I was driving. I think the worst one was a road trip to Seaside Heights where I woke up after the car accident happened and I opened my eyes and all I saw was white and it was the hood of the car resting on the windshield and I T-boned a pickup truck at an intersection and nothing happened. We all walked away, but to think, you know, I've woken up in the middle of the night grabbing my hair. Thinking of the possibilities of what could have happened. Things that I did when I was, drinking, like burglarizing places. I mean, I could have been shot, by entering somebody's home by the owner or the police. I could have died from, getting HIV. I had sex for money. I shared syringes. I got robbed at gunpoint twice, where I was actually, what I would do is, in the good days, these are the good days I'm talking about, I'd go to the bar, and by midnight I'd pull the Irish goodbye and disappear, and I'd go to shady parts of Brooklyn, and I was so drunk, this guy came up to me, put a 25 to my chest, right on my heart, placed it, and he said, "Give me your money." And I was so drunk, I told him no. And we played cat and mouse. It happened in an intersection, lots of people around. I don't know why. He gave up and walked away. Yeah. True story, you know? And that's what I'm telling you, like, and the overdose between alcohol and what the big book calls high-powered sedatives. I did a lot of high-powered sedatives. woke up 3 times, to EMTs sticking syringes in me, with adrenaline shots, to revive me. From what I hear, I was blue. My lips were blue. One time a police officer woke me up in the middle of a winter. It was morning. I was out from the night before, and I was passed out on Avenue B and East 6th Street, laid out, and the cop was poking me with a stick. And I woke up. I was freezing. And, you know, so I'm glad to be here. Stan, I'm glad to be here. I'm glad to be anywhere. I remember having a good childhood and sheltered and you know, my parents did a great job, and I remember, I think, like when I was a teen and I started to get some independence, I wanted to go out and experience the life and experience the world, and I sought out kids that were having fun, and the kids who were having the most fun were the kids who were drinking. And so right away, I tried to be friends with them. I started smoking cigarettes. I'm not saying cigarettes is a gateway drug, but I'm just like saying that it's showing my ability to make bad decisions. And so I started smoking right away. And consequences began immediately, although they were just like straws, like on the camel's back, just the beginning, like, excessive absenteeism and failing classes and staying out all night and fighting with my family. It wasn't enough. I mean, I was just getting started, you know, and the good times lasted, honestly, for about 3 years, till the end of high school, till I was about 18, when my friends would some graduated, went to college, some got jobs, they all moved on, and I still wanted to party, and that was the life for me, and that's what I wanted to do, and I continued to do so, and my consequences just kept on building up, and they were noticeable. I lost weight, I never had a job, let me see what else. I never graduated high school because I had to, for my first arrest, I had to do 10 days at Rikers Island. I would guesstimate that I was arrested in my, career so far 20 times and four times doing county, two times probation, some community service. I'm pretty sure that when I got sober, the crime rate in my neighborhood dropped dramatically. And it was assaults, and I'm not trying to be funny, I'm not trying to brag, I'm just telling you how it is. It was assaults, GTAs, possession of stolen property, robbery, just a list. It just goes on and on. Everything just kept on working. Speeding up to the end, I was living in a rooming house, $75 a week, with a bunch of people with the same disease as me, the whole house. It was the only place I could live. I was on welfare. I got a check every 2 weeks. I got Medicaid and food stamps. Whenever I received that money, it was gone within 24 hours. The grocery store on the corner gave me 80 cents on the dollar for my food stamps. Cash, that was gone one day. I had a cash paying job. At the end, I was a landscaper. It didn't matter if I showed up or not. My boss paid me in cash, and I can borrow money from him during the week. And that's where my life was. It was just, and in between, I was just committing crimes at night. It was when I was brought into the office. I was on an outpatient, alcohol and substance abuse program where the, chief of staff brought me into her office and was trying to tell me that I needed help. And I was trying to tell her I was just an occasional user on the weekends and stuff like that. And yeah, I know. And she took out my file, and she had everything documented on what I did that year, and I just broke down and cried, and I agreed to go into treatment, into detox and rehab, and that's where I first heard the message of Alcoholics Anonymous 13 years ago. I spent the next 10 years coming in and out of the rooms. I can tell you that my life got good when I stayed sober for periods of time. And my life got bad when I drank. It led me back to the same place. As the book says, incomprehensible demoralization. That was me. And I have 2.5 years now. It's the longest that I've ever been sober. And I have it because I have a program of recovery through this 12 steps of AA. Which protects me from the first drink. Not only protects me from the first drink, it has improved my life. It's a program where I don't drink, that I trust in my higher power, that I clean my clean house, that I make amends to other people, that I'm of service to other people, and I have a fellowship of other alcoholics. That's how I stay sober. I didn't do it right away like that. I mean, you know, my first year, I went to meetings. I didn't drink. But I didn't do it right. It took a year of living without a program where I couldn't live without it, with alcohol, and I couldn't live without it before I actually hit a bottom where I was going to drink, kill myself, or do the work. And I did the work. And coming to Atlanta Group was amazing. You guys, I describe it as being part of the Verizon network, because I'm like, like when I'm here, like, you know, the commercial, and then you cut to the wide part, and there's like 1,000 people behind them. So that's the way I see it. So to the newcomer, keep coming to meetings, get a sponsor, and life will get better. Thank you.
Our main speaker tonight is Cynthia.
Hi, everybody. I'm Cynthia, and I'm still an alcoholic. Hey there. Well, service definitely keeps me sober, and I thank this group very much for giving me my commitments year after year. I appreciate it. Thanks, Heidi, so much for asking me to speak last night. I didn't have much time to obsess or to obsess over the roots that I didn't have done. So you'll take me the way I am. Thanks. My sober date is coming up. It's St. Patrick's Day, 1994. And yeah, this is obviously my home group and my sponsor, who I may mention once or twice during this qualification. Her name is Arisa, and she used to be a member here. She's now residing in Boston with her family. And I was grateful enough to have her take me back. She moved north, I moved down to the Jersey Shore, and we parted ways. And for a little while, I had some sponsors and name only down there. And then I had one kooky sponsor by the name of Cynthia, and I was sponsoring myself for a little while and running by, you know, my ideas, and, you know, I was brilliant. But it ran me into a wall, as some of you know, and I was back, you know, on my knees. Sent a very lengthy email to Arisa one night. She called me up in the morning and asked me the same question that she asked me during my fourth year of sobriety when I met her. She said, are you willing to go to any length to protect the sobriety that you have? And at that point, you know, I was desperate again, and I said yes. And she took me back, and she not only brought me, you know, to where I am today, but she also sent me to another fellowship, and I wasn't happy about that. Actually two different fellowships, and I had to, get some experience there, because I was, my defects were coming out sideways, and I was, you know, doing some damage to other people, and, you know, obviously most of the damage was to myself, but at that point I may have drank, and that was scary. My story is like this. I always felt like I was the square peg trying to fit into a round hole. And growing up, and I don't blame any of this on my disease, but just like my ability to cope, was that I always, you know, wanted to be somewhere else. You know, I was the fourth girl in my family, and I had a little brother, and my mother used to scream at me, and or all of us, and say, I never want to have all you kids. I just want to have a boy and a girl. And do the math, you know, and I just felt like that. And I didn't fit in there. And then when I went, you know, started hanging out with the kids at school, you know, I felt like that I needed to be elsewhere. You know, I wanted to be friends with the kids that were older, and, you know, always trying to be somewhere else. And never feeling comfortable in my skin. And, you know, thinking back, and especially with Facebook today, like being reunited, right, with the people from my past, it's like, wow, you know, I had a lot of friends, a lot of connections in different areas, but they weren't true friends, you know. They were just acquaintances that I could hang out with, you know, to get me where I really wanted to be, which was, you know, intoxicated and
kissing other boys, you know, and other, and most their boyfriends, you know, and that just made me feel good for some crazy reason. And I was just thinking back by like 18, 19 years old, Jersey had those books where, magazines where it said like what bars were having, what specials, what nights, and I had a place to go every night of the week and different friends to be with every night of the week. And I knew what I was drinking because of the specials, you know, that were going on there. And, you know, just always having to be somewhere. And after high school, I immediately, started taking secretarial jobs in the city while all my friends were going to college. And, you know, again, just trying to fit in somewhere. And, I was getting fired from job after job after job, but I wouldn't let anybody know. You know, I just like, I lied. I lied about everything. You know, I lied about just everything. You know, my life was so untrue that I had to believe what I was saying. And it's hard to keep up. And you guys, some of you may know that, you know, it's really hard to follow, you know, that insidious, you know, like path of, you know, who'd you say what to and, you know, now what, you know, when they're asking you questions and you forget, you don't remember lies. Like the truth is easy to believe, to remember because it's the truth, you know, it doesn't go away, but your lies, you know, are just, it's hard. It's a hard life, you know, being an alcoholic. And, so anyway, as, I came to realize that, you know what, I can't work these day hours, you know, hours just, and morning and alarm clocks just don't work. And I had the best job in the world. I finally got a bartending gig up the street from where I lived. And, a good friend of mine's brother was a DJ. And we just had a really good time. You know, every night that we were together ended up in the same debacle, you know, in the DJ booth, in the bathrooms, back at his place and, you know, waking up in the morning and doing that, you know, embarrassing walk out of his mom's house, you know, the mother, yeah, I've known them all my life. They lived on my grandparents' block. So, you know, I like kind of felt like I was part of the family anyway, but you know, still that walk of shame, you know, mascara and what else is missing. And then we started bartending in Hoboken, which was a lot of fun. And, him DJing But the people around us, they were growing up, you know, and they were getting engaged and planning weddings and buying houses and mortgages and stuff. So Mike had a great idea that he let me in on, let's get married. And I was in fear. I said, okay, because I felt like we weren't even boyfriend and girlfriend. We were just drinking partners, you know, and just knew how to have a good time. But I guess I just went along with it out of fear because I kind of felt like if I don't do this now, then who's going to marry me down the road? And so I just went along for the ride. And, we were together for 5 years. And again, the lie, you know, imagine going to bed and waking up next to the person that you don't even want to be with. You know, that was every day. So obviously, you know, it's easy to continue what I was doing all along, escaping through alcohol. And, but unfortunately, poor Mike. I mean, I tortured him. Like literally, he would take our laundry and go out to his parents' house on the weekend while I was working, and he'd show up with black and blues and, you know, like bumps and the poor kid, you know, making up excuses for whatever. And they would take me in and, you know, make believe that nothing ever happened, but I'm sure they probably all knew, you know, what I was doing to their son and brother and, you know. But it was just a way of life. And I remember I used to feel like this is the hand, that God dealt me and I have to live with it and I have to make it work, you know? And, we both started college at the time, and that's hard to do, like taking 21 credits and bartending 40, 50 hours a week. So you're so addicted to making cash and trying to pretend you're married and trying to pretend the social life and then the side boyfriends, you know, or affairs. Yeah, like Lauren, I knew I was cheating on my husband. I just didn't know I was going to be with the best man. You know, it's like, that's another thing. It's like going down the list, like, oh my God. But, anyway, just I was trying to, you know, do all these things, you know, and while I was trying to do all these things, I was getting very sick. Not just, you know, from the drink, well, I guess from the drinking, but I was always, with chest cold, head cold. Like, I was always constantly ill in the doctor's office at Rutgers. And then to the point where Dr. Samuels there, said, there's been an outbreak of tuberculosis on another campus. Let's give you a blood test, a TB test. And, my arm blew up. And she said, well, now you go for the chest x-ray. Thank God it wasn't in my lungs yet. She said, it's in your system. We have to put you on this medication for 6 months. She took me off my birth control pill. Thank God, you know, nothing happened there. But because it gets broken down in the liver. Well, that was like years already passed. But it gets broken down in your liver, and you absolutely cannot take a drop of alcohol for 6 months. And this was October 92, and I said, okay, I'll start it January 1st. And she said, no, you start this now. And we went back and forth, and then she said, I'm going to make you an appointment upstairs with a drug and alcohol counselor. And I was so annoyed at her, like, you know, and then they put me in the student group. I was 25, 26 at the time, and now I'm hanging out with, you know, kids that are 19, 20 years old, and how do you get, they had a couple years sobriety. How the heck do you do that, Heidi? Like, who the heck gets sober in their teen years? Like, how do you do that? I couldn't imagine, you know, and I didn't think they had any credibility. I thought that they were lying to themselves, to us, because that my life was a lie. But I showed up every week. For some reason, I was attracted to get up and go there every week. Sure enough, 5.5 months later, I couldn't even finish a 6 month run, but, with the medication, and I started drinking again. And from that April till October was really, you know, really bad. I mean, Mike's blisters were, you know, bubbling. Like, he really got the brunt of it because I was so miserable and he was the closest thing to me. And, that mischief night, October 30th of, 93, my other college friends, the drinking ones, came into Hoboken and we started at the restaurant where I work at and, went to, another bar that people from Hoboken don't go to, and I was dancing with the town bum there. And then I went to the last bar where my husband was DJing, and I told him about, you know, dancing with Henry, who, by the way, probably has like 8 years sobriety now. And, yeah, I love it. And the next day, waking up and obviously sick, thank God for hangovers, because I was a hangover drinker, you know, every day just felt like crap. And my usual throwing up, my cleaning up after me, whatever. And then he started telling me what I told him the night before about dancing with Henry. And, you know, the vomiting went into, you know, Exorcist. And I was like, oh, my God. And I got down on my knees. And this is what's like, I still can't even believe, like, this day. I get down. We didn't even have a bed frame, so it was pretty low. I was lower enough already, but I got down on my knees and I was like looking up at the pipes and I like was praying to God, because we lived in a basement apartment, and I prayed to God and I asked, you know, for help. And I said, I think those kids at school are right. I don't drink like a normal person. And it finally dawned on me. And that, you know, that was a year, October to October. You know, it took me a year of going every week to the drug and alcohol counselor and the student group. And that was technically my last drink. And, over the next few months, I went to a couple meetings here and there, but, you know, I didn't want anything to do with you guys. You know, it wasn't pretty like this, where the meetings that I went to, it was different. And, March, I was on a cruise with Mike, and I mean, our marriage was in the pots anyway, but I was just feeling so crappy about, now it's St. Patrick's Day and I can't even drink and nothing in my life is right, you know. And, they were doing some beer drinking contests around the pool, and, the chug-a-lug was for couples only, and I said, sign us up. And he was like, no, you don't have to do that. You don't have to do that. And I said, yeah, St. Patrick's Day, it's okay, you know. And we entered in this contest, and beer was my drink of choice, by the way. I liked Coors Lights, you know. I mean, I bottomed on margaritas at East L.A., but Coors Lights was my drink of choice. I don't know what kind of beer this was, but it was warm and it was in a can. And again, thank you, God, because when I put the warm, very carbony beer to my lips, it felt like daggers. And I don't even know if the beer got past my lips, but I felt it. It was very physical. And I jerked it away and watched Mike finish his beer in like 4 seconds. And then I just broke down and I said, like, I apologized and cried and I said, I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it. And, to me, that day is very significant. And the rest of that trip was because, and I said this before, I've never been suicidal, you know, God willing, I have never been up to this day, but that night I was on the back of the ship looking at the water and I was thinking to myself, how much easier would his life be? How much easier would my parents' life be? And everybody that I've touched up to this point, their lives would be so much better without me in it. And I don't know, I guess, you know, some sort of grace brought me away from the back of that boat or lack of courage. And I stepped away and I don't know what happened, but another bartender in town started going to meetings and she came and she was going to Rutgers too. And she ran into me at the hall in the hallways and she told me about the meetings in Hoboken. And she said, take Friday night off of work. And of course me, I didn't want to lose out on that money, but I reluctantly went and I went there with attitude and I walked into the room and it was similar to this. There was younger people there. It wasn't what I was thinking. And she had already, you know, made some friendships there. So she was introducing me to people and I was like, wow, you know, and just like what I had done in the past with found pockets of people, you know, everywhere. Like I felt like, all right, now, you know, I could start a new life, you know, and that's all I wanted. I just wanted to be comfortable somewhere else, you know, like, and that's, I clung on to that in the beginning. You know, in that basement apartment, like hosted a lot of parties, you know, we'd stuff 100 people in there on a Saturday night and it was hot. And I had so much fun in my first few years of sobriety, but just fun on the outside, you know, and it was during my fourth year and I, obviously Mike and I had broken up and divorced, but, and I was now living with, you know, the next hostage, but, I was, we had rented a house down the shore, a group of us, met a young kid down there who was going to be moving to Hoboken. And I got his ear one night at a AA dance in Belmar and started telling him about my woes and whatever. And then he asked me, like, where are you in your step work? Like, what steps are you working on? And all of a sudden, you know, I got caught and I didn't feel like lying, you know, and I told the truth, you know, and I said to him, I have no clue about this. You know, I'm just here for the ride. I'm just here for the fun. And, he said, I'm going to help you. I'm going to ask my sponsor if I could help you. His sponsor gave the okay until, you know, you could find someone else. And, he started bringing me through the book and working me through my steps. And I was in the middle of my fourth step and his sponsor from Florida, told him to come here. And it was September, but at this point, when he moved to Hoboken, came to this group, came back to Hoboken and said, you have to take next Tuesday off. Came here and I was like, wow, you know, this is great. Mike had asked Vince to sponsor him. Vince would pick Mike and I up in Hoboken. He lived in Jersey City at the time to bring us to Ava's for bagels and Big Book. And, you know, I had gone to that meeting for a few times, but still never really talking to anybody there. I had gone away for a few weeks and I came back to find out that this kid, Mike, had relapsed. And I was like, whoa, I was scared. Really, really scared, petrified. Because here was somebody who I thought had some knowledge, and that's what he had, was knowledge. And now he's strapped to a gurney. I mean, literally strapped to a gurney. People were telling me, you know, what had happened. And, that next Sunday, it was a couple days later, I went back to Ava's and Arisa walked over to me and she said, are you okay? And now this is for the first time I'm talking to a woman and telling her the truth. And I said, no, I'm not. I said, remember that kid that brought me here? He's in the hospital and he relapsed and he's really bad. And I said, I need help. And of course, you know, this is what we do, you know, and she took me under her wing, and we started over from the beginning. She needed to know me. I needed to get honest with a woman, and she started me on my journey, and my journey has been, like, for the most part, incredible, and there's been, you know, some roadblocks, you know, as everyone has had. During my ninth step amends process, I got turned away by somebody in the program, and that was a little disheartening. But I mention this specific amends anytime that I speak because it's the greatest one. I made an amends to my dad shortly after he had had a stroke. After he had a stroke, for the first time, I was able to show up for someone in my family, and I was at the hospital every day, and I was at Kessler Institute every day after that with him, baking meatloafs and, you know, learning how to do building blocks and, you know, whatever he needed to do, I was there. They let me stay with him every day. I don't know why they even let me do that, because they have specific visiting hours. I somehow manipulated my way to get there every day. I just needed to be there with him. And when I went to make my amends to him down the road, he, you know, his reaction, I never saw my father cry before, you know. And he was just didn't want me to go any further, you know. He was like, we're clean, you know, we're clean. A couple years later, during my parents' 49th year of marriage, they separated. And my father, and let me tell you, even though we made that amends or whatever, I never had, like, true, like, friendship with my parents. My father moved in with me. And, you know, like, it was life-altering and amazing, both at the same time. My father's moving in with me, you know. And, you know, thank God I have a poor family, and I was able to move him upstairs, like, 6 months later. But, so he's with me now, still today. And a couple years ago, my mother had a stroke. And now this is a woman where she's very hard-headed, stubborn, and, you know, set in her ways. I don't know the miracles of whatever medical things happen during strokes, but, like, it seems like her memory got wiped away, and all of a sudden she turned into a nice person. I don't know what happened. But we are now, yeah. And my father asked me, he said, listen, when mommy gets out of rehab, can you, you know, can she come here? Now, you know, like, it's tough. I didn't know yet that her memory was wiped away. You know what I mean? I was scared. We never got along. You know, the woman who said she never wanted to have all these kids, you know, I didn't think she liked me. You know, I never felt a part, as much as I disconnected from my family, I didn't even think they wanted me there anyway. And she moved in with me, and those first few weeks were extremely difficult because we had to share a bed because she needed to sleep by the bathroom. We slept in the back bedroom, and she needed assistance getting up out of the bed. And she had a bladder problem. So like, wet the bed and needed her diapers changed. And, like, all of a sudden, I'm turning into a mother, you know, and being sleep deprived for a few weeks too, which, you know, that was, like, pretty stressful. But I was able to be there, you know, like, sleeping next to my mother. You know, I still can't even believe that this happened. You know, thankfully my sister's worked on a senior building around the corner, and now she's in the senior building. But now, like, I see at least one of them every single day, where I ran from them for 30 plus years of my life. Never, ever did I want to have a conversation with them, be in the same room with them. And now I have relationships with them. And, you know, as the, you know, past few years have gone on, you know, with both of them back in my life, as stressful as it is, like, I could actually appreciate now relationships, because I know it's very difficult. Like, I sometimes, like, I'm like, oh, you know, poor me, because that's one area of my life as far as having a significant other I have not been very successful with. But, you know, when I look at those two, I know that it's not all cracked up what it's supposed to be, and that maybe I'm not really missing that much. But as much as that is, you know, I do have, you know, I have, like, a great relationship there. But another thing as far as relationships that Arisa and, you know, a couple of of my, like, sober sister Kelly and Gina, who can't be here tonight, and other women in the room. Like, I never had that before. You know, I used you. Okay. I wanted to measure and get whatever you had that I wanted, you know, and now, like, to actually share things with other people has been, like, an incredible, you know, part of this past, like, 11 years since I've been, you know, coming here. And, you know, obviously one of those friendships, you know, blossomed and we became very close. And I remember I was just talking to DC about this before, when we were walking here from the deli, that, I remember when Becca became a chair person, when we voted her in as chair, we were laughing one night talking about, like, service commitments. And I said, can I give a handwriting sample because I'd like to do name tags? You know, I said it like kidding around, and then next thing I know, I'm doing name tags for the next 12 months. And, like, but as far as, like, showing up and being present, I, like, that experience during, you know, all right, maybe most of the room may not even know Becca. Becca was, you know, a good standing member of this program, of this meeting, chairperson, and had passed away. May will be 2 years of lung cancer. But just watching someone so close to me go through what she went through is, like, amazing. You know, like, during that time, how can I possibly think that any situation or problem in my life was worth worrying over when it wasn't life-threatening, life-altering, you know? And just to be able to show up and be there out of my own fears for mortality, you know, out of my own fear of not even, like, thinking that I can be capable of being a good enough friend, you know, that all I needed to do was just show up. You know, I didn't even have to talk to her, you know, when she was going through it, just for her to know that someone else was in the room while she was going through that, you know. That's dignity and grace, and you can't buy that. You can't learn that in a bar. I can't learn that on Facebook, you know. Like, that's something that we learn here through this process. You know, God's grace has definitely brought me out of some, like, danger zones in my own head. And that's what, you know, my sponsor said that, you know, I should share about tonight, because the past few months have been extremely, like, challenging. You know, obviously, I understand that everybody's having, you know, financial and whatever, you know, things going on in their lives. And, you know, I talk late at night with Gina because she's a night owl as well. And, you know, I feel like that's when I get most honest and out of, you know, the stuff that's going on. And, you know, talking with her, and she said, Cynthia, I think you need to, like, hit a meeting every day. You need to show up and see what you could, you know, bring and find a newcomer. And that's, you know, for someone to be so close to me to be saying that, I'm like, you know, like, tuning in. I need to hear that. And I started hitting an afternoon meeting down by me, and all of a sudden my two sponsees start showing up there, you know, and it's so awesome. I mean, I don't have any more than that right now, but to be able to see them, like, every other day. Normally, you know, maybe I'll see them once a week and their phone calls when they check in. But now, like, we're, like, being attracted to each other, you know, and that's just awesome. And the other day, Saturday, I was very busy at work, and I still work in a restaurant. And other than working in Hoboken, I also work in a restaurant down by me. And my mother comes in sometimes on Saturdays for lunch. She took the taxi, and she was chatting up with a group of customers of mine who, in Hoboken, everybody knows I'm sober, but down by me, they don't know I'm sober. I don't want them to know I'm sober. And she starts chatting up, and I overhear her saying something, and I go over there, and she's breaking my anonymity to a group of my customers. And red, I must have been purple. I was steaming, and I am like vulgarities are coming out of my mouth, okay? And I am, you know, like, I could not get my message across to her enough, like, without strangling her. I was so upset with her. And, You know, I walked away, and I do what, you know, I'm taught here, you know, call up the guy upstairs. You know, obviously, he shows up. He is there no matter what. And, you know, I may not drink again. I may drink at work. I may have to drive 15 miles to get a drink. I don't know. But at that moment, I was like, you know, ready to kill somebody, not drink, but act out. And I tapped in the simplest prayer, the serenity prayer. I love it. And I was able to get through the next 45 minutes of my shift, get dressed in the bathroom, and drive up to Brooklyn to attend Kelly's, my sober sister's wedding, without like doing, you know, what I would normally want to do is throw her up against the wall. And that was amazing. And then I'm driving and I'm thinking to myself, so what? So what? Are they not going to tip me? Are they going to fire me? You know, like, who cares? Who the heck cares? Why is it so important? And like, that's amazing, you know? And, you know, I've really have had such wonderful experiences that are so priceless. They should be in a MasterCard commercial, you know? And I really, really, really love my life today. And, you know, just thinking back, you know, thinking that I was having a good time, no way. And if, you know what, even 10 years ago, in my, you know, 4 or 5 years sobriety, if you would have told me that I was going to be, you know, sharing a bed with my mom and having the relationships with my family, even sober a few years, I probably would have said, nah, you know, no thank you. But today, I wouldn't trade any of this for the world. And I thank you so much for my sobriety.